So the derivation of this
was one. So we're only going to assume it's omission. When the reason is that assuming it's to check positivity of this is a more difficult condition to check. You have to basically diagonalize it and see that all the eigenvalues are positive. And diagonalizing a matrix is not a trivial thing to do. But whereas to impose that it's omission is a trivial thing to check, because you just check the entries above the diagonal are the complex conjugates of the ones below. So these two conditions give us, well, the first condition, that trace of rho squared equals 1, tells us if you write this density matrix down in the basis in which it's diagonal. So we just want to prove that this gives us the pure states. We don't have to actually do this. It's just a proof that this would work. So trace of rho squared equals 1 tells us that the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues is 1. And trace of rho cubed tells us that the sum of the cubes of the eigenvalues are 1. Let's see. Well, this equation 1. Equation 2. So this one implies that each eigenvalue has a magnitude which is less than or equal to 1, because these are all positive. And the eigenvalues, incidentally, are real, because it's an omission matrix. Which implies that 1 minus the eigenvalue is greater than or equal to 0, because this thing can't be bigger than 1.
Why does it imply that the eigenvalues are positive?
Say again, sorry?
Why does it imply that the eigenvalues
It doesn't imply that the eigenvalues are positive.
Just that the modulus.
It implies that implies that the so these two equations are the same.
Yeah.
Well, that's not right. Anyway, this one implies this one. This equation is just saying that the size of the eigenvalues is not bigger than 1. You know, whether it's positive or negative. Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
Because you have a real number here. You take the square and sum them together equals 1. So all these squares have got to be positive.
Yep.
So none of them can be bigger than 1. But then this must be true as well. Okay. Now, if you take equation 1 minus 2, then you get this proof, incidentally, is due to Chris Fuchs. The original proof is more complicated. So here I'm just subtracting this equation from this equation. And so now we have this number. We know it's greater than 0 because it's a square of a real number. And this number we've just established is greater than 0. So we have a sum of numbers that are greater than or equal to 0 products, so this times this is greater than 0, being equal to 0. And that's only possible if a sum of terms which are each positive and equal to 0 can only be equal to 0 if each of these products are equal to 0, which means either this is equal to 0 or this is equal to 0. Okay, so either, so lambda I is either equal to 1 or 0. If lambda I is equal to 1, then this thing is 0, and so we're okay. And if it's equal to 0, then this is 0. So this has to be true. But now if we look at equation 1, we can see that actually only one of them can be equal to 1, because the sum of them is equal, sum of the squares is equal to 1. So equation. And the remaining ones are 0. So that tells us that we have an omission matrix which in diagonal form corresponds to a pure state. Basically, only one of the eigenvalues is equal to 1, the remaining ones are 0. Okay, so that's the mathematical proof. Okay. So the interpretation.
Okay, so both of them in combination tell you that the density matrix corresponds to a physical state. Why don't you just have the first condition, like trace rho squared equals 1,
yeah,
and assume that it was Hermitian? It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical state.
Yeah, right. So you could have, if you just have the first condition, you could have this condition, but a lot of these terms could be like negative, something could be negative, something could be positive.
So you need that second condition.
So this second one makes sure that they're all positive. Yeah. Okay. So lost my notes. So I want to talk about the direction I think quantum foundations needs to go in, and sort of how that sort of influences some of the work that's been done, a lot of the work that's been done in the field today, certainly my own research, but also other people as well. I think it's good, in these kinds of courses, of course, like quantum foundations, everyone actually has an opinion. And there are all these interpretations out there, so it's sort of it's good to say which is my preferred interpretation, which is none of them. They all have problems. I think there's so I don't I, did Rob get a chance to do much on interpretations? A little bit. Okay. You probably talked about the landscape, but there's various interpretations. Like there's the many worlds, there's the Bori-Bohm, Copenhagen. Collapse models, there's cubism, there's a whole list of different interpretations. They're all trying to solve the problems, try to provide an understanding of quantum theory, either solve the measurement problem or avoid it in some way. And it's sort of, you can imagine, I think the problem is that that resolving the interpretation problems of quantum theory could end up being just an academic exercise. So if you look at a historical example, when Newton came up with his law of universal gravitation, he was very concerned because it seemed like he had these instantaneous influences at a distance, that the two masses provide a force on each other. And it was instantaneous. And even worse than being instantaneous, there was not even any mediating substance. It was sort of just the two things that were. And it was only later when Einstein came along that that you had an explanation for that, that it wasn't instantaneous, in fact, and that there was a mediating influence which was curvature of space-time. But you could ask the question, well, what's the best interpretation of Newton's law of gravitation? You know, if people had sat around at the time trying to come up with the best interpretation, what would they have come up with? And of course, it's difficult to say. Probably people would have come up with all sorts of different interpretations, just like today we have all these different interpretations of quantum theory. But in retrospect, the best interpretation is clear, and it's the interpretation you get if you take the C tends to infinity limit of GR. So the C tends to infinity limit of GR gives you a theory which is called the Newton-Cartan theory. Carton, I think. I don't think these two guys collaborated. So the Newton-Cartan theory is the theory you get here. And then what happens is that when you take the C tends to infinity limit, it stops being a theory of space and time, space-time, but it becomes a theory of space and time treated separately. So you still have a sort of absolute time evolving forward, but space still has curvature. And it's curvature in space that that gives you Newton's law of gravitation. So Newton's law of gravitation comes exactly from curvature in space. It's still instantaneous because you have this C tends to infinity limit, but it gives you Newton's law. So it's sort of academically interesting that this limit exists and that this would be the best interpretation. And had those guys, you know, sat around and talked about it long enough, they might have come up with this, but they probably wouldn't have done because it requires a concept, curvature in some sort of geometric sense, that they wouldn't have been motivated to think of at the time. So if you fast forward to today, when we've got the quantum theory, and people are trying to come up with an interpretation, we could be in exactly the same situation that, you know, that we're trying to understand the measurement problem and all these different things in quantum theory, but we're simply not looking at it from the right point of view. We need the next theory, and then we can look back and maybe we can see what the best interpretation was, although it would be of academic interest, but it's not the best thing. So it seems to me that the best attitude is to try to use these sort of conceptual tools that have been developed in quantum foundations to see the way forward to a theory of quantum gravity. Then we can look at that, and maybe, you know, if we're lucky, when we get to a theory of quantum gravity, it will suggest its own interpretation. It also may be that it doesn't suggest its own interpretation, but we can just, you know, wait and see until we get there. So that's sort of my general attitude towards the interpretation of quantum theory. So with that in mind, it's worth thinking about this problem of quantum gravity. And then I'll use that to motivate some of the sort of work on foundations that's being done at the moment. So the problem of quantum gravity is to find a new theory, which we can call quantum gravity, which reduces in appropriate limits to general relativity on the one hand and quantum theory on the other hand. And so it needs to at least reproduce those aspects of general relativity that have been observed to be true in experiments, and likewise at least reproduce those aspects of quantum theory that have been observed in experiments. And then So you want to find some mathematical theory that has this property. And of course, to really be the correct theory of quantum gravity, it then has to be empirically verified. It could be that there's more than one such theory. It could be that there's a unique theory like that. So it's worth looking at these two less fundamental theories and seeing what kinds of properties they have. If we're going to, in a sense, the problem is to invert this diagram to sort of go against these arrows. So so let's look at these two theories. Well, it turns out that there are sort of radical and conservative features that they each have. The conservative feature of general relativity is that it's deterministic. If you specify in an appropriate way some boundary conditions, then all the physics is determined by that. This is actually not completely trivial in general relativity. There's something called the hole problem that it's a bit less trivial than you might think, but in any case, it is a deterministic theory. Whereas quantum theory is probabilistic. In fact, it's in some sense, it's inherently probabilistic. There's not really any way of writing down the rules of standard quantum theory without introducing probabilities. There are, incidentally, interpretations of quantum theory, which are deterministic. So the Du Broglie-Bohm model, which you'll probably cover with Rob, is deterministic, although it still has statistical probabilities in it. Okay. So these are the conservative features. But the radical features are that general relativity has non-fixed causal structure. What I mean by that is, if you, when you set up the theory, imagine you're interested in you have two points that you identify in some way. So this could be the point where two fluid blobs intersect. This could be the point where two other fluid blobs intersect. And you're interested in whether this separation is space-like or time-like, whether this one is ahead of this one or vice versa. The way to determine the answer to that question is to find the metric. But the metric is something that you solve for. It's not given up front. It's not constant. So the causal structure isn't fixed in advance. Rather, it's something that you solve for. Quantum theory, on the other hand, is very conservative when it comes to causal structure. It has fixed causal structure.
I got
confused. Can I this is the this is fixed. So it seems that, once you've let the probabilistic cat out of the bag, it's going to be difficult to get it back in. And so in a theory of quantum gravity, we would expect it to be probabilistic. It doesn't have to be, but that's reasonable. And likewise, with the causal structure, once you've let the varying causal structure out of the bag, it's going to be difficult to get it in. So it seems likely that quantum gravity will be a theory that's both probabilistic and has non-fixed causal structure. But actually, it's likely to be a bit more radical than that, because in quantum theory, you have this sort of property of indefiniteness, kind of no matter of the factness. If you have a particle, for example, that can go along this path or this path, then you have a superposition of the particle being here or here. So there is, in some sense, no matter of the fact as to whether the particle went this way or this way. Invented a long word. Causal structure is something that can vary in general relativity. So it seems likely that that's also going to be subject to no matter the factness. You'll have indefinite causal structure. There will be no matter the fact as to whether the causal structure between different places is space-like or time-like, whether this is ahead of this or behind this in time, and so on. That seems like a likely feature. So we need a framework. That can accommodate probabilistic theories of indefinite causal structure. And so if you have a mathematical framework like this, then you can start to impose perhaps some sort of principle. So just like when we had this the reconstruction of quantum theory, we had a set of postulates, and we used those postulates to get quantum theory. Likewise here, if you have some framework which is suitable in this way, maybe you can impose some postulates there. Okay. So in sort of 2005, I sort of wrote down a framework which was suitable for this. I called it the causaloid framework. More recently, other people have written down frameworks which have the same features. So roughly, I forget the year, 2010, 11. The group in Pavia have a framework for indefinite causal structure, and likewise the group in Vienna. So I don't want to go into what the causal framework is in detail, but it sort of motivates a way of looking back at quantum theory, which I'll talk about, so a way of reformulating quantum theory. And furthermore, it motivates a kind of a framework for studying quantum theory, which does have definite causal structure, but it somehow is more suitable for thinking about this step, the theories which have indefinite causal structure. Okay. So if you look at standard quantum theory, it's worth thinking about why it has fixed causal structure. Okay. Why do you need to have a fixed background causal structure to do quantum theory? And there's sort of two reasons. One reason is typically in quantum theory you have a state at a given time, and you evolve it forward in time using the Schrodinger equation. Um, And in order to be able to do that, you need to have some notion of space-like hypersurfaces. So this is a foliation, you know, into space-like hypersurfaces. And that means that the time interval from one space-like hypersurface to the next one is a time-like interval. Like if you go to the nearest point, and likewise, sort of in the vicinity of this point, you need a space-like interval in the space-like in the hypersurface. That to have that, it requires a notion of definite causal structure. There's no way that you could have these notions of space-like hypersurfaces that foliate your space-time unless you had definite causal structure. So that's one problem. Now the second problem is to do with the sorts of ways you use the mathematical objects. So consider, here's an example. Imagine we have two qubits. And the qubits pass through a bunch of gates like that. Okay, it's a very simple situation. Then imagine you're interested in just what's happening here in A and B. What's the appropriate way of combining these mathematical objects that pertain to here and here? So where you have space-like separation. And the answer is that you take the tensor product. So you take some operator here and take the tensor product with the operator there. But what about B and C? This is where we have time-like, but it's immediately sequential. In that case, you take the product of the matrices, or the product of the operators. You just take A times B. Is that clear? So for example, if these were super operators, you'd just have, oh, sorry, should be B and C. If these were super operators, you'd act on your quantum state, first of all, with the super operator corresponding to B, then with the super operator corresponding to C. Did you do super operators? Did you call them CP maps in Joe's course? Yeah. Okay. And so these two things are very different. In this case, you're taking the tensor product. Also notice that in this case, imagine these are qubits. So then the super operator acting on a qubit lives in, let's see. A qubit described as a density matrix has four parameters in it. Then the super operator acting on a qubit takes it to another density matrix, so it has 16 parameters in it. So each of these super operators has 16 parameters in them. When you take the tensor product, you get a new matrix which has 16 squared positions in it. So you get 16 squared, whatever that is. 236. Whereas here, you're just taking the product of these matrices, so you still just have 16 parameters. So in the case where things are immediately sequential, you have all this compression. You have two objects each having 16 parameters, but you end up with a new object only having 16 parameters. Whereas when you take the tensor product, you get 16 squared parameters. And then there's another question. What about when you have B and D? If I want to consider B and D, is there some mathematical object that pertains to B and D without, by itself? Any ideas there? So I want a mathematical object. So here I gave you a mathematical object that pertains to this and this one. Here is a mathematical object that pertains to these two. But what about one that pertains to B and D? So people don't normally, you won't find this kind of thing in textbooks, but you can invent a mathematical object. I'm going to call it the question mark product. So this is the tensor product. This is composition product. And you define it so that when it acts on C, it equals BCD. So you can think of B question mark D as being the appropriate mathematical object that lives in these two boxes. Okay, and this object here also has 16 squared parameters in it. So you can see that for every different kind of causal structural situation, if it's space-like, immediately sequential, or sequential but not immediately sequential, you associate a different mathematical object. And the way that you go about using those mathematical objects in the theory is very different. So quantum theory really needs to look at the background causal structure. So that's a problem that needs to be overcome if we take seriously the idea that we should have indefinite causal structure in a theory of quantum gravity. Okay. Okay, so I think I want to show you now the Dewar tensor framework. And it solves some of these problems. It treats these different situations on an equal footing, and it doesn't require a foliation into space-time. It still has definite causal structure, but it doesn't have these problems in the same way. I was wondering if I should use slides. It's maybe harder to do it. If I press, what do I do? Press. Okay. So, right, and then let's go into my computer. Oh, this one. Sorry, I'll just take a minute to set up. 5 seconds. And thinking about it. Yes. Okay. So what I'm going to show you pertains to a situation where you have circuits. So this is everything I showed you before. notice the notation. I'm using a particular kind of font. This is sans serif font in the diagram. We have these operations. So operations are boxes that have systems of certain types going in and certain types going out. We imagine they come in up the bottom, up here, the bottom, and then they go out at the top. We can also use this sort of symbolic notation to describe the same thing. And then you need these indices for reasons I'll explain. And each operation has associated with it a certain setting. And also it has a certain outcome associated with it. And the outcome is, you know, if that outcome happens, then you say operation A happened. That's this here. Actually, it's, instead of associating a single outcome with these operations, it's good sometimes to associate a set of possible outcomes. You know, so maybe the set might be, you know, maybe there's three lights that can flash on this box, red, green, and blue. And you might be interested in the set where the red light flashes or the green light flashes. Okay, so you're kind of coarse graining. Otherwise, it's the same. And we can wire these boxes together. So here's two boxes wired together, like so. And we can write the same thing down in symbolic notation. So here's the two boxes. But here you can see this B wire that connects the two boxes is has the same number. So let's see, B4 here and B4 there. And that's the reason you need these integers in the symbolic notation, because you need to be able to say where the wires go. All of the other wires have different integers on them because they're not connected. So you can describe a circuit in this language. A circuit has a circuit. All the wires are closed, so every wire here has to have a subscript and a superscript. So A1, for example, is also connected here. So there's A1. The wire goes from A to C. Here it is on the diagram. And then you can have fragments of a circuit. So here's a sort of general fragment of a circuit. You can have fragments of a circuit which are associated with preparations, which are called preparations. So those are the ones that only have output wires. And those are associated with states, like we talked about before. And then you can have results, which have only input wires. And those are associated with effects. So in the old formulation of quantum theory, I'm not sure exactly how Joe Emerson presented it. But if you want to do even operational quantum theory, then you need a foliation. So if you take a circuit like this, and you want to describe this in the old formulation of quantum theory, then you have to foliate it like so. So for a general circuit, there are many different ways of foliating that circuit. Like you can see, for example, this foliation wire could have come down here instead of going up there. A general circuit has many different foliations. If it's a DAG, if it's a DAG, a directed acyclic graph, then you can be sure there does exist at least one way of foliating it. DAGs do always have a way of foliating them. So now, if you want to calculate the probability for this circuit, remember, each of these boxes has an outcome on it. We want to calculate the joint probability of the outcomes associated with all these boxes happen. In standard quantum theory, what you do is, well, you start off with the initial state, which is some density matrix associated with system A, tensor product with some density matrix associated with system B. So that's this. And then you evolve forward. And you have to go past boxes D and C, and also along a stretch of wire here. So box D has some transformation associated with it. And this is tensor product with box C, and then here you just have the identity because there's no box in there. So this is the thing that evolves the state from time one to time two. And then you need to evolve the state from time two to time three. So the same kind of story. And then finally, you have a measurement at the very end, which is like this. This is just some projector associated, or some positive operator associated with this box at the end. So that would be the standard way of doing a calculation, because then you take the trace of this whole thing. So there's various problems with this, sort of relating to everything I just said about quantum gravity. You need to impose some arbitrary foldation in order to do the calculation, even though this foldation isn't part of the physics. So the physical world doesn't have some foldation in it. That's just something that we impose in order to do a calculation. And we also have to pad the calculation with all these identity maps. So every time you have two foliation surfaces cutting through a single wire, you need to have an identity. And the treatment is disunified because we're treating all these different boxes in different ways. So preparations are treated like this as density matrices. Transformations are treated like this as CP maps. And and results on a measurement are treated as positive operators. And each of those is subject to its own kind of constraints. So I have 15 minutes, so I won't go through all this. But the story is the following, that you can get a formulation of quantum theory. I'm calling it the operator tensor formulation, which doesn't have any of these problems. And it's more consistent with the kind of stuff I was just saying that's behind the screen there. But a necessary stepping stone to that is to set up a GPT, which I call it the Dewar tensor framework. So it's a general probability framework, which is good for looking at these kinds of circuits. Okay. So the way it's going to work out, here is that circuit again. Here's the description of that circuit as in symbolic notation. This is diagrammatic notation. In this framework that I'm going to show you, the probability for this circuit is given by an expression that looks like this. So this is a bunch of operators associated with the different boxes. It has some sort of tensor-type structure because we have subscripts and superscripts. And every time a wire is repeated here, so here is A1 and here is A1, we're taking a kind of partial trace in the appropriate parts of the Hilbert space of these operators. So this is a different sort of framework, and it doesn't have those problems. And it's motivated by thinking about these problems of quantum gravity. Okay. So I'm going to see how far I can get in setting up this Dewar tensor framework. So it's a sort of mathematical framework whose purpose is to calculate probabilities associated with these circuits. It contains one assumption, well, contains a few assumptions, but it also contains the local tomography assumption that I talked about before. So the first assumption is a more basic assumption. We just assume that you can associate a probability with any circuit, and that probability is given just by specifying the structure of the circuit, and it doesn't depend on anything else. So, what I mean by that is if there's other circuits or other stuff happening, it doesn't affect the probability for this circuit. you can show from the thing I just told you that if you have a circuit which has two disjoint parts like this, then the probability, the joint probability associated with both circuits is just the product of the probabilities for each of the two circuits taken separately. You can show that just using a little bit of Bayes' theorem, sort of simple probability analysis. Okay, let me just look forward a few slides because I'm wondering how much time I have. I'm also noticing that these slides haven't formatted correctly. I don't know why that is. These are the same slides. I think they formatted okay. 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 Are there any questions at this stage before I sort of look at this some more? Okay, well let me just continue. So in order to set this framework up, we need to define a function. I call it the P function, and it's defined like this. So it's the P function takes as its argument a sum of circuits. So A, B, C, et cetera, correspond to different circuits. Then alpha, beta, and so on are real numbers. They can be negative. And so we define the P function just like this. So it's sort of linear. And the P function of this expression is just equal to alpha times the probability of A plus beta times the probability of B, and so on. But this seems like a funny thing to define because we're taking the function of a linear sum of circuits. But it turns out to be very useful, and you can use it to define a notion of equivalence. It's sort of similar. Really, it's just this is like a vector. You know, if you take a vector, it's a linear sum with weightings of certain vectors that point in certain directions, and those vectors are things that exist, you know, in the physical world. Well, likewise, we're taking a linear sum of circuits. These circuits are things that exist in the physical world, and we're taking a linear sum of them. So it's not such a strange thing. And now we define a notion of equivalence. So we'll say, so these things, did I skip a slide? So I'm going to define a notion of equivalence. First of all, I'll give you an example. So here are some preparations. A is preparing a system of type A here. So we have alpha times A plus beta times, alpha times A plus beta times B. And these are both preparations. We'll say that's equivalent to this thing here if, when you take the p function of this with some result, then it's equal to the p function of this with some result. And this is true for all results. Is that clear? That means? And the reason for doing that is because if this this result closes this preparation into a circuit, and likewise this one. So what we have is alpha times a circuit plus beta times a circuit. So we can take the p function of that and see if it's equivalent to this. We're getting to a sort of operational notion of equivalence between these linear sums of circuits. We have a general notion of equivalence. And we have expressions like this. Expression, this is just a number, alpha plus beta times a circuit plus gamma times a circuit. This is a number alpha plus beta times something which may not be a circuit. It may be a general fragment. So it may have some wires coming out of it. Likewise, B. We're going to say that two expressions are equivalent if the p function of expression one times some fragment that closes this fragment, the fragments in this expression, into a circuit is equal to the same thing for expression two. So going back, the thing I just showed you was an example of that. And so we have this here in general. So this is a way to define equivalence. Go ahead.
Can you explain the first term in your expression?
This one here?
Yes.
Yeah, what's that doing there? Okay, so I'll give you an example where that's relevant. I'm glad you're keeping up. So one thing to notice is equivalence isn't the same idea as equality. It's a funny notion. And here's an example that really makes that clear. So you can prove that any circuit is equivalent to the probability associated with that circuit. Okay, this is true for any circuit. A circuit, don't forget, is something that has no wires coming out of it. A fragment is something that has wires coming out of it. Okay, so here's a proof. Well, the most general fragment that can close a circuit into a circuit is just another circuit. Okay, so take the p function of A times E, where E is now a circuit. Since A has no open wires, the only thing we can put there is another circuit. Now we know that the probabilities factorize, and the p function here is just equal to, since there's no linear sum, it's just equal to probabilities. So we know that this is equal to p of a times p of e. But we also know the p function is linear because of the way it's defined. So you can take this p of a and bring it inside here. Just write it down as the probability of a. So we can see now from this expression that this circuit A is equivalent to its own probability. Clear? That really demonstrates that equivalence is a weaker notion than equality, because obviously a circuit isn't equal to a number. A circuit is a thing in a laboratory, whereas a number is a thing inside a mathematician's head. Is this clear? It's all. I feel like I should just go back a few steps because it's. So we start off with this notion that you can associate probabilities with circuits. From that it follows, I haven't shown you this, but it's pretty straightforward, that probabilities factorize when you have disjoint circuits. Then we define this funny function, this p function on a linear sum of circuits. Circuits, remember, are things that have no open wires. We use this to define a notion of equivalence. So here's an example. This is a linear sum of preparations. And they're equivalent if they have the same p function for any way of closing them using some result, for any result. Then we can set up this notion of equivalence in general. So the general form of an expression is the thing at the top there. And we have the a notion for equivalence between expressions. And then here's an example. The probability of a circuit is a circuit is equivalent to its own probability. Okay. So So now we can use this notion of equivalence to do some work. So first of all, I'm going to consider a set of preparations. So for the moment, just forget about, imagine this is not a triangle, it's a square. Then it's a preparation for a system of type A. And ignore this thing here. I'll explain that in a moment. But what I want to consider is a fiducial set of preparations. So remember, in the case of quantum theory, you could consider one fiducial set of preparation for a qubit would be would correspond to spin up preparation, spin down preparation, a spin x plus preparation, a spin y plus preparation. In the sense I'm going to be explaining, these preparations will constitute a fiducial set, and they would be sufficient to express a general preparation. So here we have some label. Now this A, so this is a system type, whereas this A here is a number, an integer that goes from 1 up to kn. So in this case, it would go, you would label this, 1, 2, 3, 4. And this would be my A label. So here we have a set of preparations, a fiducial set of preparations. And we're writing them like this. And we've given them this extra label here, this A. And there's a black dot on that. And now we can say, for any preparation, we can write it down in terms of its fiducial set. What we do here is we say that this preparation is equivalent to some linear sum. So in the previous slides, these numbers here were given by things like alpha and beta. But now they're given by what looks like a tensor, except it has a pre subscript rather than the post subscript. Let's not worry about that at the moment. Times the fiducial preparations. So this being equivalent to that, that's a particular example of the kind of equation I showed you before, like this. Here's one equivalence. The example I'm showing you now is another thing like that, except we have, and of course, we use Einstein summation notation, so we take a linear sum over this subscript, which is repeated. Okay. And we can write this same thing down in diagrammatic notation. We can say this preparation is equivalent to a linear sum of fiducial preparations. So this is just a diagrammatic way of writing this symbolic equation. Okay. Well, it's already 11:15, so this is just the beginning of the story. But I'll show you how to set up a general GPT framework, which uses this kind of approach. And I guess that'll come teaching again next week, Thursday and Friday. Is that right? Okay, so I guess I'll summarize this stuff before I carry on next time, because you may have forgotten it.